American businesses need more skilled workers. How do we find talent and develop it? And how do we create opportunities for everyone in our society to find a good job and build a rewarding career? I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation, a nonprofit media company telling stories about the future of work, the future of education, and closing the job skills gap. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace through conversations with innovators, educators, and decision makers, people with solutions to today's workforce challenges. On today's show, Western Governors University describes itself as education without borders. This fully online university is the nation's first and largest competency-based university, designed to give all students access to the education they need to compete for work in our evolving economy.
We specifically align the learning outcomes of our programs and curriculum to map to the competencies and skills needed in the workforce, particularly where the workforce is going. And healthcare is a great example where we work closely with industry and our partners and employers in that space and experts that we could rely upon to shaping curriculum that directly address the needs for value-based healthcare.
Scott Pulsiver has been the president of WGU since 2016 and is driving the continuous reinvention of the school's curriculum and the faculty's interaction with its students. Pulsiver tells me, the WGU mission is always front of mind, ensuring more people have greater access to a college education and making certain that education is preparing them for the future of work.
We were established over 20 years ago. The name Western Governors University has its heritage in the fact that governors of 19 Western states in 1996, I think it was, actually voted to effectively fund the formation of a new type of a university, an institution that would focus on improving the quality of post-secondary education and aligning it with the future of work, while also increasing access, especially among the underserved populations that existed within their respective states. And that underserved population, it meant, you know, the adult learners, it meant those that were in rural populations or that were in low-income categories, military populations. You know, a large portion of their resident populations were not able to access education the way they needed to. And so that was the endeavor that really began the WGU mission. And that mission is still the same today, to effectively reinvigorate the promise of higher education as the surest path to opportunity, and working to make that possible for everyone, not just those who are from, you know, higher income households or from backgrounds that have that process or pathway for them. And so today, WGU has been in operation since 1999 when we enrolled our first student. We now have about 120,000 full-time enrollment. We have over 170,000 graduate alumni across the country. And we are a leading provider of bachelor's and master's degrees and other credentials across business and technology and healthcare and teacher education. So it's been a real thrill to be a part of something that has started from whole cloth.
So the world's changed a lot, technology's changing. You know, we talked a lot about the future of work here. Are you adapting your curriculum to serve, you mentioned healthcare.
Yes.
That's a really, really big growth industry in the country. So are you adapting your curriculum to churn out people?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. In fact, one of the more fascinating ways that I think became a differentiator for WGU's approach is that we specifically align the learning outcomes of our programs and curriculum to map to the competencies and skills needed in the workforce, particularly where the workforce is going. And healthcare is a great example where we work closely with industry and our partners and employers in that space and experts that we could rely upon to shaping curriculum that directly address the needs for value-based healthcare, the greater coordinated care that needs to be provided to individuals in the future, the accountable care models that are around the funding and payment models that exist for the future of healthcare. And that led to the advancement of our master's in health leadership. That's all about the integrated care and coordination. And that is that's true not just for our programs in healthcare, but for all of our programs, is that specifically we are trying to perpetually improve the alignment of the learning outcomes directly with the future of work, And that is coming sooner and changing more quickly now than it ever has been. And so that's been key for our success.
The whole history of your university coming, you know, being formed by a governor's association, which is pretty innovative in itself. Yeah. So do you see in this space, how else are you trying to innovate? I mean, it seems like that's your model to begin with.
Yeah. Well, I would say that it all starts with a complete obsession about putting the student at the center of everything that we do. I think we are absolutely clear about what our priority is, and that is to improve the probability that every type of individual can attain the credentials and the learning that they need to be successfully on their path to progress and prosperity. And so when we put the student at the center of everything we do, you start seeing things differently around how does a student, you know, matriculate into a program? How does a student adapt through the learning that they're going through, given the knowledge that they have, the methods in which they learn, how they utilize technology to augment that? How do you rethink the faculty engagement with an individual student? How do you think about the technology and all the data and the information that it can provide about how you better align and adapt, again, adapt the learning journey to an individual? I think that's allowing us to think differently about how you prepare students for success into post-secondary programs, how you personalize the learning once they're in their programs at the course level and program level, how you even transition and align the transition from education to the jobs, how you support them, serve them, engage with them. All of that stuff to us is helping us, putting the students at the center of everything we do, is helping us see challenges or blockers or even just, you know, fundamentally new ways to do things that drives us or compels us, if you will, to just keep thinking differently. I think it's fair to say that what we believe is that what we've done to this point is not what will get us to where we expect to be in the next 20 years.
You know, one of the things, it's a cliche now, I guess, or a saying now, that talent is equal, but opportunity is not. How do you bring in that group of people that you were talking about before that you would really like to help get educated?
Yeah, we believe that same thing, which is, yes, it is that talent and opportunity are both abundant, but the pathways between the two are not universally available. I think that's the evidence that we've talked about before, or that Tony Carnevale's advance. It's like, it's better to be born rich in this country than be born smart. It's like, you know, that affords opportunities and gateways that many don't have. I think the way that WGU is endeavoring to do this is really two elements, and it is access and attainment, because access is truly, how do you remove barriers to even the on-ramp? And some of those barriers are you can even easily see today in some of the political candidates who are saying, yes, affordability is a problem. We've endeavored to make not just financing options available, but really, how do you just make it lower cost? So even if you need funding, you should still make as low as possible funding as possible so that they can acquire it at a more affordable rate. But even if you make it affordable, what about time? What flexibility do these individuals need?
A lot of older people in particular have families, yeah.
Not only older people, but even the traditional students. Like we really talk about more the working learner. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The majority of students across the entire higher ed enrollment are working. And that makes constraints on time. And time is the one resource that we have you don't get more of. And so how are you designing to increase flexibility of time? That obviously in leveraging a virtual delivery model and allowing them to earn or learn independent of time and place, redesigning the faculty engagement to be more student-centered rather than faculty office hour-centered. These are examples of how you create flexibility for a time dimension. There's also place and geography. Like, what if you don't have to go to a classroom? What if you don't have to be there at a certain time or on a campus?
You're in Salt Lake City, right?
Our headquarters are in Salt Lake City, but all of our students are virtual. We don't have a single campus any student ever has to go to. You never have to be in a physical classroom. And so you start to address or bring in flexibility there too. So when it comes to access, we are trying to address issues that create barriers that make accessing education inflexible to adapt to the individual situation and context. The other thing is attainment. What we also know is that individuals come with different levels of knowledge in different domains. They also learn in different ways. They learn at different paces. But in traditional education, there's a standard model. If it works for you, then you'll be fine. If it doesn't work for you, you stop out. Our model is, how do you take the whole of everything that we do, faculty engagement, learning resources, technology-enabled, you know, learning aids, like, how do you take all of that and make it adaptable to the individual again? So that individuals can go at their own pace. They can emphasize the areas they need to learn versus accelerate through the things that I already know. How do you get faculty engaged with them on a one-to-one instructional model versus a broadcast
model?
How do you do that
in a virtual campus?
Think of this way, is like, instead of having lectures in a virtual context, it's just content. It's just like watching an episode of a sitcom or something like that. I can watch it when I need to watch it, and I can watch portions of it that actually augment the learning that I need to have, rather than having to sit in a classroom for an hour or three times a week.
If they need the teacher or the professor, is there an option?
So we actually viewed that, so like a lecture, that to us is just content, so it's a learning resource. So now the faculty-student interaction is all one-to-one. It's like 24/7 office hours. It basically says all the instructional engagement you're going to have with faculty is for you personally. That faculty member is going to engage with you to help basically you learn how you need to learn and the areas you need to emphasize for the course that you're in. You also have a faculty mentor who has a master's degree or higher in your program field of study, who's going to be with you from the day you start until the day you complete our program. And they're also helping you deal with all the other demands so that you can plan in the right order, you can sequence your learning, you can prepare better for your assessments, you can deal with disruptions to your plan that are often life issues. But that faculty mentor is there to basically advise you through your entire program. This is something that is truly, I think, unique to WGU that doesn't exist anywhere else, and probably one of the single biggest contributors to our ability to help individuals achieve attainment that they weren't able to do elsewhere. That's how I think we, when it comes back to, is how are we trying to serve really this diverse population of learners? You have to address issues around access, which have a lot of flexibility, and you have to personalize the journey through the learning so that individuals can leverage their strengths and then adapt to their development areas so that every learner can be successful, and not just those for whom a standard model works.
I've read that you really like to use data. I'm a data nerd, so sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Is this how you determine like what to offer your students, what the consumer wants? Tell me a little bit about how you're using it.
So we pretty much use it for everything and anything that we can. And we have this saying that if you can measure it, you should. Or if you can know, you should. And that we don't just, we don't just make decisions on intuition alone. I think it's a combination of intuition supported then by data. And data applies to virtually everything. From the time you're coming through our readiness and our on-ramp, how do we then help design the sequencing of the courses in your programs? What kind of mentors should we be assigning to you? How do we expect you to utilize the technology and the learning portals as a student? But then you start engaging. And just like the first time you start using Google Maps, it's actually learning as to where you're going, how you're going through that, what tools and what transport you're using, et cetera. And it starts making your recommendations. Well, the same theory applies also to learning. So in terms of personalization and adapting the learning journey, is like, well, that's based upon how you as a student are engaging with your faculty, engaging with the learning resources, your sequencing courses, your performance on assessment. All that continues to inform how we can better adapt to your learning approach so that we can increase your success. The other way we use data is we're big believers in randomized controlled trials. That when we want to change a faculty teaching model, when we want to utilize a different learning resource, when we have a peer-based solution that we want to try, anything that we do, we actually want to utilize randomized controlled trial methodology so we can truly test and isolate the efficacy of that solution on, does it improve student outcomes? And that's something we believe versus, hey, we implemented it, it seems to be working. Those who had it like it, but that doesn't really tell you, does it isolate for selection bias? Were those students who are going to be successful anyway, the ones who used it? Like, can you truly prove through randomized controlled trials that what you are identifying as a learning theory, that it actually works in improving outcomes?
This sounds like a good way to address the issue of sometimes people go to college and they get no guidance at all. It's almost like you got your virtual guidance counselor giving you a pathway to where you want to go.
Yeah. That faculty mentor, that is definitely one of the roles that faculty mentor plays for every single student. But that's not the only thing that faculty mentor
does. Well, it sounds like the data can help too.
It does.
It gives you some guidance.
We have what we refer to as the Learner Care Dashboard, This is all the environment that the faculty mentors are actually going to specifically for every one of their students, and they're seeing is like, here's how the progress is happening with the student. This is where they're engaging. These are recommendations as to how you can help them and nudge them along. We also utilize that nudge framework within the technology itself, so that it's giving them prompts and recommendations and kind of notifications to say, hey, here's how you can keep going forward. When it comes down to our student student success, I mean, we probably really focus on progress, pace, persistence, satisfaction, and ultimately the key thing is attainment. But we have many input variables that are influencing those measures, and our goal is to continue to inform those with data.
So you have a business background, Amazon, and then a company that was purchased by IBM, I believe.
Sterling Commerce, yeah.
Does that help you when you're thinking about how should we change higher education to adapt to the current economy?
I suspect that what we're trying to do at WGU is really apply the best problem-solving and management mechanisms possible. Education itself is also a process. You know, there are consumers of that education. They're the primary individuals that we need to serve. We are thinking about the key results that matter in that context. And so, if anything, you know, business or that kind of private sector of things, you know, they're very thoughtful about how you continue to improve the value proposition for the customer. I think in the context of WGU, even before I started, I believe unique nature of WGU is that put the student at the center of everything we did, and that student focus has then forced us to think about, all right, the process of enrollment, the process of teaching, the process of, you know, learning resource engagement, the process of financial aid. Like, if the student is the individual that we're trying to serve and the measures of success are progress, persistence, completion, etc., like, how do, as management thinking go, how do we forever improve that value proposition so we can increase the outcomes and success, and we can expand the number of individuals that are going to be successful in that process? And so that management ethic is its continuous improvement. And we are not afraid to kind of slough off the past to invent the future.
Are you still on the White House Workforce Advisory Board?
I am, yeah.
So, sounds like an arrogant question. What are you bringing to that board?
Yeah.
What is it that you want to talk, what do you talk about when you're there?
I think the fundamental reason that that board was established is recognizing that if we're on the cusp of the fourth industrial revolution, and technology and intelligence and information are rapidly changing the nature of work, the goal of that board was, if you think about the pathways through individuals have to journey to be prepared for that future, which honestly is already happening. So it's, when we say the future, it's like, it's already changing now.
I always say the future of work is now.
The future of work is now. And the question is really just the adoption curve and the duration of that adoption curve is like how much and how quickly of our economy is shifting to that kind of intelligence information driven model. And the goal of that Workforce Policy Advisory Board is, well, all of the individuals we have today within that workforce, 160 million plus Americans, how do they get readied for that? And how do they manage through that transition? And there's simply a recognition that education, post-secondary education, alternative pathways of education, like employers, you know, associations, like they're gonna be a key part of this because those 160 million adults are being served by these institutions. And so our perspective is, how does higher education and how do new and alternative providers of educational pathways, how do we have to adapt and where are we going to put the emphasis and priorities to help that workforce transition to as quickly as possible, quite frankly, to that future of work?
So my final question is, do you think higher ed is moving fast enough and in the right direction?
I think the answer to that question would be depending upon your context and your perspective. So I would, not being able to speak for the whole of the sector, I would at least say that there's some promising acceleration that's occurring within certain spots of the whole sector. Example would be the rapidly accelerating pace of virtual delivery. the internet is definitely increasing the pace at which we can expand access to high quality education in a way that it's really started to accelerate. So that's very promising. I think there are new pedagogical models that are starting to be adapted. I think there's changing nature of how we think about the stackability of learning, that we're rethinking the currency that exists within education to work. That stuff is promising. Does that mean that, you know, traditional institutions with student life experiences, athletics, et cetera, that all of a sudden their budget models are going to shift everything really quickly and overnight? Probably not. Like, I think many things will persist for a time. But the accelerating pace of that change, every institution is going to have to figure out from which context are they starting and what's going to be the impact of those trends, and how are they going to be influenced by them or contribute to them so that they can be meaningful and a contributing institution in the future of education.
Well, you said it very well for someone not speaking for the entire
higher
education.
Yeah.
Thank you, Scott,
for sitting down with me. I appreciate it.
Work in Progress is produced by Working Nation, your source on the future of work. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, and my guest today was Scott Pulsifer, president of Western Governors University. To hear more about the future of work and workers, subscribe to Work in Progress wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to our producer, Larry Buell, and executive producers Joan Lynch and Melissa Panzer. Our engineer is Daniel Turek. Our theme music was composed by Lee Rossevere. See you next time.